Landed his PhD in Australia, at the University of Queensland, 2011.
10?
10? Yeah, I wouldn't know. And was since then a postdoc at Caltech, and recently he took a second postdoc with Steve White. He will tell us about tensor network pre-normal animation.
All right, is this on?
No, this is only the part.
Oh, yeah, sorry. All right, thanks for the introduction, Giffrey. Yeah, so as Giffrey said, today I'm going to tell you about this new work that is in collaboration with Giffrey called Tensor Network Renormalization. So hopefully by the end of the talk, you will understand what this diagram means. Okay, and what this Tensor Network Renormalization, or TNR, is a new RG-based method to contract tensor networks. And this is applications towards simulation of quantum and classical many-body systems. So before I discuss in detail any of these aspects, I thought it would be very handy to give sort of a brief overview of exactly what is a tensor network and how do they relate to many-body physics, and also just some sketch of how this new approach is different from previous approaches. Okay, so I'm just giving some outline of the talk before I go into any of the particular details. Okay, so we're going to be dealing with tensors, which are just multi-index objects, and I'm going to be drawing them. So this four-index tensor, AIJKL, I'm going to represent as just a blob with four legs. And this, so each leg, I'm assuming, is some index, has some dimension chi, so it takes on chi different values. And we call this typically the bond dimension if it's uniform. Okay. And when we draw two tensors connected together, this implies a summation over that shared index of the tensor. So using this diagrammatic notation, we can write sort of very complicated summations over tensors. So this is some interlaced network of many tensors. We can just depict them as something like this. Okay, so this diagram here represents this big sum over all of these indices. You could also equivalently write it as a tensor trace over my tensor A. And because, so I'm assuming this arrow means it connects with the bottom one, so periodic boundary conditions. Okay, so I've taken some four-index tensor. I've arranged connected indices with other tensors, and this has no open indices. So if I were to do all of this summation, this would just contract to a scalar here. Okay, so hopefully this is probably a lot of people have seen this type of notation before. Okay, so and this is very much the task we're focused on today is how do I contract a network of tensors down to the scalar? So this is sort of a very easy problem to pose. Like I could give you this A tensor, four index tensor, and say contract the scalar if this is 4 by 4 or arbitrarily large network of these tensors. So it's very easy to understand the problem, but this is a very difficult problem to do in practice. Typically very difficult. And the reason we might want to do this is that if you can contract a network like this down to a scalar, if this is a d-dimensional network of tensors, then you can formulate in such a way that you can compute local expectation values or correlators of a d-dimensional classical statistical system, or you could compute properties of a quantum many-body system in one fewer dimensions than this network. Okay, so just having this network, just having an ability to contract this network, you can sort of formulate a lot of many-body physics. You can simulate or compute properties of many-body systems. And there are also lots of other applications for why you might want to do this type of contraction. Okay, so there are generically many different strategies you could try and employ to take this network to a scalar. Today, I'm going to be focused on renormalization-based methods. And what I'm doing, so my initial network, I'm doing some kind of coarse graining or renormalization group transformation to bring it to a coarser network where this A naught is my initial tensor. And now I'm getting some new tensor A1, which probably differs from the original one. And I'm doing this coarse graining until I have, for instance, just one tensor left. And from that, I can sort of directly extract my scalar. Okay, so in practice, I'm going to be doing something like blocking several tensors together. So doing some contraction to take several tensors to one tensor, and then doing some kind of truncation in order to sort of reduce the double index down to a single index. So again, later on in the talk, I'll be discussing the details on how one might accomplish this. Okay, so one thing we notice is that this type of approach, this renormalization approach, gives us this RG flow in the space of tensors. So we start from some initial tensor, and we apply it, and we think about getting some coarse grain tensor and a sequence of increasingly coarse grain tensors, which maybe if we have a finite system, we go until log n times until we stop. Or if we have an infinite system, maybe we can get information from looking at the fixed points of this flow. Okay, so there have been many previous approaches based upon this kind of idea. You can think sort of the genesis of this type of idea probably dates back to the 60s with, say, Kadanoff and spin blocking ideas. But sort of the modern approaches, I would say, started with this paper by Levin and Nave in 2006, where they formulated what they call the tensor renormalization group. And since then, there have been other developments that, for instance, try and improve the accuracy, try and address some of the issues of that arise in this tensor renormalization group. So we'll be talking a bit more about this tensor entanglement filtering by Zhengxin Gu and Xiaogang Wing later on. And for instance, there are other generalizations that allow this to be applied in higher dimensions to study two-dimensional quantum systems that would be difficult, that could be difficult with other methods. Okay, so today I'll be talking about this new approach to this, tensor network renormalization, TNR, which we're going to have a paper on the archive shortly. And how this differs from all of the previous approaches is that this new approach generates a proper RG flow in the space of tensors. Okay, and this is a very important and relevant point in a number of reasons. So what exactly do I mean by a proper RG flow? It's kind of a mysterious statement. So this flow of tensors should give us what we expect from renormalization as we usually think of it. So for instance, if I'm looking at a 2D classical Ising ferromagnet, so this is probably most people are familiar with this, it's just the simplest model with a phase transition in it. So it has a second order phase transition at some critical temperature. Below the critical temperature, it's in some ordered phase with some magnetization. Above the critical temperature, the magnetization vanishes. And what I would expect is that if I apply my renormalization approach to this model, this flow of tensors should converge to one of three fixed points, depending on whether I start below the critical temperature, at the critical temperature, or above the critical temperature. So if I start with two different values of temperature in this phase, I should go to some sort of fixed point A order, which is characteristic of this Z2 symmetry broken phase. If I start with any temperature above the critical temperature, I should go to some tensor. This flow should converge to some fixed point, which is characteristic of the universal properties of this disordered phase. And sort of at criticality, I should have this sort of highly non-trivial critical fixed point in this flow. Okay, so this is what we expect this type of flow to obey from the physics, and previous RG schemes didn't give us this. And now this one I'm going to show you today does give us this proper RG flow, which also has very significant consequences for how well it performs as a numerical method.
As you flow, do you end up with only one tensor representing the whole tensor or network?
So I'm considering the case, So I'm considering the case where I sort of have an array of identical tensors gets mapped to an array of identical tensors. Okay. And this could be, and in this case, this is some infinite lattice to some infinite lattice to some infinite lattice. So it's entirely characterized by just what the single tensors are. Okay. And as I was saying, this has some very, very real practical consequences, is that especially at or near the critical point, is that previous schemes, when I try and iterate this coarse graining at the critical point, the cost of doing each iteration scales exponentially in the RG step. And what I'm going to show you today is that when we do this equivalent coarse graining with tensor network renormalization, the cost is independent of this RG step, so we can, in principle, iterate as many times as we want, so we can study arbitrarily large systems. Okay. So that was just my sort of overview of the concepts involved in this talk. So now I'm going to address each of these points in more detail. So the first part of this talk, I'm going to be formulating how exactly a tensor network can encode this many-body physics, so how I can represent the partition function of a classical system as a tensor network, or a Euclidean path integral as a tensor network. The second part of this talk, I'll be talking about this previous renormalization scheme by Levin and Wynn, the tensor renormalization group, and why it doesn't give us a proper RG flow. And in the final part of the talk, I'll be introducing this new approach and saying how we fix the problems in the previous approaches in order to get this proper RG flow. Okay. Okay, so as I said, this is what we're trying to devise, is a method to take a network of tensors, do this contraction to bring it to a scalar. And so one reason we want to do this is because computing information about classical many-body systems can be represented as this. So a two-dimensional classical many-body system, you can compute local expected values, correlators, by doing one of these contractions. You could do that with Monte Carlo. So there are many strategies to try and evaluate the scalar from here. So Monte Carlo-based methods are one, like transfer approaches and these renormalization schemes. I think the main advantage something like we'll discuss has over Monte Carlo is that we can apply this tensor renormalization even when you have negative weights or complex components of these tensors. And these are cases where trying to do this with Monte Carlo, you couldn't sample efficiently. You'd have the sign problem. So this will be a bit clearer once we say how this represents a partition function. Okay, so what I'm considering is a square lattice of classical Ising spins. So just as an example of how you can encode a partition function as a tensor network. So my Hamiltonian functional is just, it assigns an energy, a number, to a particular configuration of these spins. So each of these spins can be in the up or down state, which is a plus one or a minus one, which I seem to have left off. Okay, and what this tells us is that two spins that are aligned contribute energy minus one, and anti-aligned, they contribute energy plus one. And the partition function is just some weighted sum over all of these configurations with the temperature. Okay, and what we're going to do is just looking at a plaquette of four spins. So there are 16 different spin configurations of these four spins. I'm going to use this tensor A to encode the Boltzmann weights of these 16 different configurations. Okay, so my four index tensor takes on whatever this value is for whatever these indices I, J, K, L are. Okay, and so by doing this, so you see I have for every, I have half as many tensors as I do spins because I only need one tensor in every second plaquette. Okay, so this tensor encodes the Boltzmann weights of these four. Another tensor encodes the Boltzmann weights of a different four spins. Okay, so by making this choice of what my tensors are, then the sum over all configurations of my classical spins equivalently becomes the tensor trace over this tensor network. Is that clear to everyone?
You're double counting some of the spins, right?
No, so
but like, not the interactions. The interactions are not double. Okay.
So I'm just the interactions are only, so this interaction is only counted once in this guy. Okay. So this is just one way of getting from the sort of spin model to a partition function. There are other ways you can do it. It's fine. In particular, just to make things very concrete, so this contracts the partition function. If I change one tensor and leave everything else the same, then I contract to some other scalar value, and sort of by doing the ratio of these two, so the partition function, this number is just for normalization purposes, then if I can contract these two things for sort of some impurity tensor B, then I can get local expectation values about my classical system. And if I had sort of two impurity tensors, then I could get information about correlators, endpoint correlators in general. Okay, so that's sort of the first relevance of why we want to be able to contract a tensor network to a scalar. And so the second point is that this can also be used to extract information about quantum many-body systems. So instead of representing a partition function, this is going to represent a Euclidean path integral of our quantum many-body system. Okay, so I'll just quickly go over this. So I think some significant amount of people would be familiar with this. So it's just the Trotter expansion of our Hamiltonian. Okay, so we're thinking about a 1D quantum system with some Hamiltonian that has some nearest neighbor coupling. And what we want to do is represent the exponential of this Hamiltonian for some very large inverse temperature beta as a tensor network. Okay, so this, the limit as we take this exponential of beta h to infinity is just a projector onto the ground state. So we want to be able to express this guy as a tensor network. And there are many ways to do this again. So one very straightforward way is just to think about splitting my Hamiltonian into R even terms and R odd terms. So just separating out even and odd site terms. And then we're just expanding this e to the beta h into small time steps, small discrete time steps. So the usual tricks here. This even part and this odd part don't commute, but if my time step is small enough, then I can just approximate it, approximate e to the tau h as just the product of e to the tau even and e to the tau odd. Yeah. So I just am choosing my time step small enough so that this Trotter error is below what I care about. Okay, so this is just what I said before. Just expand a small time step in even and odd terms, okay? And then we can, each of the terms, so h even is a sum of terms, but they all commute within them, between themselves, and all of the terms in h odd commute. So if I exponentiate each of these individually, then e to the minus tau h even is just a product of the exponentials of my local gates. Same thing for e to the h odd. They act on the alternate sites. Okay, so this is just the exponential of my Hamiltonian for some small time step. Okay, so to get sort of the full path integral that I want for the ground state, I just have to have very many of these evolutions by a small time step. So in principle, this should go all the way up to infinity. Okay, and of course, we can recognize this as just being equivalent to a tensor network. Again, just slanted by 45 degrees, the one I initially drew. Okay, so, and now we're associating like one direction in the tensor network with a spatial direction, and the other another direction with an evolution in imaginary time. Okay, and this is some, another way you can think about this network is it's some explicit, this is a two-dimensional network that is some explicit representation of my one-dimensional quantum ground state here. Okay, and again, just to be very clear, if I want to evaluate some expectation operator of some local observable, then I put my local observable in and take the ket and the bra. So in order to evaluate this expectation value, I'm just contracting this tensor network, which again has one impurity tensor. So it's the same procedure. Okay. And finally, I was just going to very quickly say another very direct application where this is useful is in contracting projected entangled pair states. So this projected entangled pair states, or a PEPS, is a type of tensor network ansatz for two-dimensional quantum systems. So if you know about this, great. If you don't, then I'm not going to explain it. And an important part of algorithms for dealing with PEPS, for simulating 2D quantum systems, is that you need to be able to compute scalar products of PEPS with themselves, or compute local observables from PEPS. So I've tried to draw what the scalar product looks like, but it just simplifies to a tensor network with no open indices, where I have a double index connecting each tensor. So evaluating the scalar product from other PEPS with itself is just exactly the same problem as contracting this tensor network again. Okay, so that was the first part. So hopefully you can understand how different types of physics can be encoded in this problem of taking a tensor network down to a scalar. So now I was going to sort of briefly describe this previous approach to how this is done. Okay, so as a preliminary, before I explain this tensor renormalization group by Levin and Nave, we just have some preliminary step where we have to understand how a truncated singular value decomposition works. So I have a four-index tensor, which I'm writing, which is just a chi by chi by chi by chi array of numbers. And now I'm thinking about sort of reshaping that, just regrouping indices so I can interpret it, interpret the same object as a chi-squared by chi-squared matrix. And now there is some kind of special decomposition I can do called a singular value decomposition, where I can represent this matrix as the product of a unitary, a positive diagonal matrix, and another unitary matrix. Okay. And so this is matrix, this, the values in this matrix are called the singular values of this matrix. And there's going to be chi squared of the singular values. And what I want to do is I want to truncate this, the number of singular values, or equivalently the dimension of this index between the two sides. I want to truncate it at some value chi tilde less than chi squared. So I have these different singular values. I'm going to get rid of the smallest singular values. If the singular values decay quick enough, then I can get rid of them without changing things too much, is the idea. Okay, and just as a final step, which doesn't really matter, we typically think about taking maybe the square root of the singular values, absorbing them into each of the sides. Okay, so, yeah?
Like, you know,
some eigenvalues? I mean, are you thinking about doing a gap system where...
talk about that a bit later. Yeah, it is related to... You can formulate it as entanglement, an entanglement question, like if this tensor network has some small amount of entanglement or correlations, then the singular values decay. Then the singular values decay quick enough so I can truncate them. But this will be clearer later on, hopefully. Okay, so the truncated SVD is just a way of taking some tensor and replacing it with something that hopefully approximately is exactly the same. So I'm decomposing a 4-index tensor as a product of 3-index tensors with some bond dimension I call chi tilde. And in particular, this SVD is the way I can, for a given chi tilde, get the optimal decomposition. So I'm sort of minimizing the error between my A and my A tilde tensor. And so how many singular values I need to keep in order to maintain some particular error threshold relates to the physics of the system. So as we had in the question, if the system is more at a critical point, then I might need a larger chi tilde than I would otherwise. But this should be clearer once we do some numerics. Okay. And this is sort of really the key step of this TRG approach. If you understand what this means, then this TRG is very simple. So I'm starting with my initial network of tensors, and I'm going to do this truncated SVD between, so I have some pattern of how I'm going to do it. So this red line indicates I'm going to do it between the left and the top versus the bottom and the right. So this tensor goes to these two. And I just have this sort of two-site pattern of sort of the cut going forward or the cut going back. So I do this truncated SVD, and I get this new network. And then I'm just doing some contraction step where I contract four tensors, become a new tensor of my coarser network. Okay, so it's very, very simple approach, truncated SVD and a contraction. So I call this A0.5 because I'm going to consider one step of this approach as taking, so I want twice of this to be one step of my approach. So if I do another TRG step on this tensor network, I'll get back to one of the same orientation that will be rescaled by a factor of two in each direction from the initial one. Okay, just...
Do you have any migration condition on the previous slide? Is that automatically satisfied by an SVD? You realize that it's different than the main
SVD? If, yes, this is the SVD.
So that's equivalent to the statement I'm doing in SVD.
The truncated SVD gives us this decomposition with minimal error. Okay, so this is really all there is to TRG. As you can see, this simple procedure, we generate some RG flow in the space of tensors. And I really like this approach, and in the sense it's probably the simplest method for simulating many body systems you could ever do. It's literally like three lines of code just to do a truncated SVD and do a contraction. And it can be very powerful. You can do a lot of things with it. And it's high dimensional generalization, so it's pretty good. But we can think about, there are some significant flaws to this approach. And as I said at the start of the talk, one flaw is that it doesn't give a proper RG flow. So this flow of coarse-grained tensors doesn't have the right fixed points that we expect physically, that we want. And there's also this computational flaw that we touched on a little while ago, that maybe the number of singular values we need to keep in order to do this will increase by some large amount. So in practice, it'll break down if we try and do this on a computer. It will become very difficult. So let's look at these each in turn. Okay, so my computational flaw, again, what I expect for something like the icing model is this sort of RG flow to one of three fixed points. So I have two phases and the phase transition point. What I get with TRG is that for each different value of temperature, even temperatures in the same phase, I get a different fixed point. So if I start at some temperature half of the critical value versus some temperature still below the critical value, this flow of tensors will go to a different place, which is not what we want. They should go to the same place, which is this, they should flow to some tensor that represents the universal properties of this phase. Okay, so two points in the same phase should renormalize to the same tensor. This is what we expect from renormalization. This is what I mean by proper RG flow. And this doesn't happen for TRG. I have essentially a whole line of fixed points. So each temperature has its own fixed point. And specifically at criticality, I don't even get a fixed point with TRG. It just forever flows to more and more complicated tensors. So we don't get a proper RG flow. And then we also have this, what I call this computational flaw, is that we can't iterate this approach sustainably when we're at the critical point. Okay, so what I'm plotting here is the spectrum of different tensors along this RG flow when I try and do this singular value decomposition. And what we can see is that initially, for instance, I can keep some relatively small number of singular values and keep high precision. But as I'm coarse graining, then I get to the point where I need to keep a very large number of singular values in order to maintain accuracy. Specifically, if I want to say have some arbitrary accuracy threshold of only truncating singular values less than 10 to the minus 3, then the number I need to keep at each iteration grows by some large amount. Okay, so this is the question we had before. What is the physical relevance of this truncated SVD? And in particular, what I haven't mentioned, so the cost of this, of doing this coarse graining depends on the fifth power of this bond dimension, the number of singular values we have to keep. So the cost of doing this coarse graining starts off relatively mild, but increases roughly exponentially with RG steps. So if we try and apply TRG to critical systems, we can only sort of go a short distance before this approach breaks down. So we can only analyze relatively small systems accurately, depending on exactly what system we're addressing. Okay. Any questions so far? Good. Okay, so.
Properties, for example, you may evaluate the network in some way and get this scalar out. I mean, not evaluate it in terms of contracting tensors, but looking at some structural quantities. My background is in astrophysics. So, for example, the total mass of a density distribution could be such a scalar quantity. And then as you do the renormalization flow, you want to maybe have tensor networks that have the same property. You want to preserve something as you're moving along the flow. And I haven't seen that. I mean, this seems like a rather ad hoc approach. You have a tensor network, you define some procedure, and then you flow it, and then you see it doesn't work.
Well,
my question is whether you can have a more systematic approach. For example, I don't know, the density of the spectrum or something that you want to preserve.
We're preserving the scalar that this network contracts to. So this.
Yeah, but I mean, there could be more such things that you can evaluate to to define the quality of a tensor network or something.
Yeah, it could be.
Well, you have symmetries, for example.
You can have symmetries that you also preserve, like Z2 symmetry preserved in the icing model. Maybe we can discuss this after.
Okay,
if you'd like.
Sorry, go ahead.
But I think the point of this approach is just that you could aim at exactly preserving locally the whole object that you have. So globally it's just a number, but locally it's some complicated tensor. And what he's doing is he's trying to replace this complicated tensor with another tensor which looks simpler, but it's approximately or very it's a very accurate approximation to the original one. So in particular, all properties that you would like to keep should be kept.
Okay, can you give some examples for such properties that you would like to keep?
Yes, any endpoint correlation function. Mm-hmm. Any expectation value.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is as I repeat for everyone now, as Giffra is saying, this procedure which locally preserves sort of each tensor also preserves expectation values, endpoint correlators, sort of any information we want to compute potentially. Okay, so we have these two flaws in TRG as I've formulated it. So we don't have a proper RG flow and we have some, we can't iterate sustainably. This is a kind of a subtle point. You still get the same. You still get the correct numbers out from TRG, even though it doesn't give you a proper RG flow, provided you keep the truncation error small. So you have, if you're just using it as a numerical method, the numbers you compute are fine. But what we would expect is that this tensor should converge to a particular place. So it's the, and the number you get out is a function of sort of the tensor as well as something else. So it's kind of a subtle point that I don't know how to explain better, is that the numbers you get out are fine, but this flow doesn't replicate where you want it to go.
You mentioned that you are working with path integral in momentum states. You have this RG transformation that you want it to integrate large momentum, large energies. You want to integrate that out. You formally say, okay, I'm going to integrate that, but you don't. You get an effective action which still has explicitly large momentum, large energy degrees of freedom that still need to be integrated. Right? So it's a failure conceptually. But the resulting object, you could say, oh, this is my effective action at low energies. Okay? You shouldn't be saying it's my effective action at low energies, right? But you could say it, and then it still contains the physics. You didn't lose anything by failing to remove high momentum.
Yeah.
You didn't lose. So TRG is failing to remove some short distance details, fails to remove those, so the fixed, when you apply it within the same phase, you get different fixed points, fixed point tensors, because they differ, these fixed point tensors differ in microscopic details that you should have removed. Okay, but they still give you the right answer.
So maybe, yeah, that's a simple way of explaining it, is that with TRG, you sort of keep some baggage here from the short-range degrees of freedom, that you fail to remove, but that this still contains the appropriate long distance physics, is just hidden in some other garbage there, but you still potentially can get the right answers. Yeah,
when you say when you compute all the numbers even with TRG, you mean the universal data at each fixed point, or
no, that would be much harder. I just meant the expectation values. So getting, because this doesn't go to the right fixed point, getting the universal properties of the phase, it's hidden in amongst stuff you don't want there. So one way of understanding why this TRG doesn't work is to consider the fixed points of this transformation. And the fixed points are very special tensors called corner double line tensors. So I'm imagining this is my four index tensor, but I'm imagining each index now has some can be thought of as a product of two finer indices. And then these CDL tensors are just tensors that where, for instance, these two indices are perfectly correlated. So these red lines just represent sort of a perfect correlation, a delta function between these two indices. So another way of thinking about this is that a partition function built from CDL tensors just represents a state with short-range correlations. So only degrees of freedom around a plaquette are correlated. Degrees of freedom between different plaquettes are uncorrelated. So these little red loops are just somehow loops of correlations. And if I do TRG to this network built from these CDL tensors, so I've done my singular value decomposition, then I contract four tensors down to a point, you can see that there is some loops get contracted to a point and they can be removed, but other loops remain. So in particular, I go from a CDL tensor to a new CDL tensor. So this one is the same as the original, but with some rotation. And what this is telling us is that this TRG is failing to properly address some of the short-range degrees of freedom. So some of them are being neglected. And what I've tried to draw here is I've drawn different color loops to try and illustrate this better, is that I have this state with these short-range correlations. TRG gets rid of some of them. It gets rid of the red ones. But for instance, the green ones propagate to the next length scale. So this is some problem with TRG. It's artificially promoting short correlations to larger length scales. So this is why it's failing. Okay, and this is why we don't get the correct fixed points, is because we're sort of lugging this baggage around with us. Okay, so one thing you can say is that my effective theory will always have some dependence on the microscopic details. You'll never get rid of it. And this is a problem because we want to get rid of the microscopic details to get the universal information. And this is also how we can understand this breakdown, computational breakdown at the critical point, is that each iteration I'm failing to remove some of these correlations. So at the critical point, these keep accumulating over successive iterations, and I'm accumulating sort of more and more of these short-range correlations, and I can't do it computationally anymore. Okay, and so this, and what I'm going to explain in the last part of the talk, is our attempt to fix this accumulation of short-range degrees of freedom, or this failure of TRG to properly address short-range degrees of freedom. And I should just say at this point that Zhengsheng Gu and Xiaogang Wen also have proposed an approach to sort of fix this RG flow that's only works in kind of limited circumstances. So what we're doing, I will show you, sort of works everywhere for the phase, sort of even at criticality. Okay. Okay, so just the final part of my talk, I'm going to introduce TNR. Okay, so before I tell you what tensor network renormalization is, we just have a slight change in the formalism we're using. So previously, the key step of TRG and other renormalization schemes has been some kind of tensor decomposition. For instance, this truncated singular value decomposition, where we sort of optimally replace A with some A tilde that has some rank of chi tilde. So what I'm going to do, instead of doing a tensor decomposition, I'm going to think about applying some projection, some rank chi tilde projection onto my A tensor like this. In particular, and what we want to do is choose this W such that the error between this and the initial one is minimized. And what we can see or argue perhaps is that if I choose my W equal to this guy, this U tilde, then so just replace W with U tilde, then this U tilde dagger acting on A just gives me singular values times this V dagger. In other words, what I'm saying is we've just changed the formalism to do exactly the same thing. So and this way, I'm using the truncated SVD to try and get some optimal decomposition into rank 3 tensors. So I can just do something equivalent, which is apply a projector where this projector aims to minimize the error between this projected tensor and the initial one. So this projector is aimed to act as an approximate resolution of the identity, and then these two things are equivalent. So I've just introduced a different method to do the same thing at this point. Okay, so this is one key ingredient for tensor network renormalization, is that instead of doing truncation, instead of doing singular value decompositions, I'm going to think about putting in projectors of the form WW dagger that can mimic the effect of a truncated SVD if they're chosen appropriately. So they can act as some approximate resolution of the identity. And I'm also, the second key ingredient is even simpler to understand, is that so this leaves my network approximately invariant so long as these are chosen appropriately. If I have some little part of my network, if I put in a unitary and its conjugate, then this leaves things exactly invariant. Yeah. So this is even simpler to understand. And now I'm going to build a renormalization scheme by sort of composing these steps in a particular way. Okay, particular, so this is just a reminder of what TRG looked like, singular value decompositions and contractions. Something that would be exactly equivalent but just slightly reformulated is to, rather than doing SVD, I put in these WW dagger pairs of projectors and then contract in a certain way. So as we've seen before, this inserting projectors can be equivalent to doing SVD if it's chosen appropriately. And the reason I want to recast things in this formalism will be clear once we start doing something more complicated. Okay. In particular, so now my tensor network renormalization. So first I'm going to put in, before I put in my projectors, I'm going to apply some unitary gates in a certain fashion between my tensors. So these are exact resolutions of the identity. This putting these in here doesn't change anything as far as the partition function is concerned. And in practice, you could put it in symmetrically, but in practice, we only need half of them to make things work. So we just use half. Okay, so I put in my U and U dagger, and now I'm putting in my W and W dagger pairs of isometries. Okay, so if I took out the U and the U dagger, this would be equivalent to previous RG schemes. But now I've got this extra ingredient in here. And now I contract sort of certain groups of tensors down to new four-index tensors. Okay, so I've gone from my original square lattice to a coarser one that's rotated 45 degrees, but also has a two-site unit cell. And now I just do something. Now I just do exactly one iteration of TRG or one half iteration of TRG to bring me back to a one-site unit cell. Okay, so yeah, just going from here to here, I just do the SVD in the normal way that I do with TRG. So this is sort of one full iteration of my TNR algorithm that takes my initial lattice to my coarser lattice here. And we're going to call these guys disentanglers. For those people who have seen, say, Giffrey talk about the mirror, these sort of fulfill a very similar role and actually more deeply related as well, as we might see later on. Okay, so how does this disentangling step help? So maybe one way to see this is to go back to this formalism of corner double line tensors. Okay, so with TRG, you're missing some short-range correlations. And what I'm doing is, when I have a plaquette of four tensors, if I put in a U and a U dagger and then sort of absorb them into the tensors, this U and the U dagger can kill off this loop of correlations. So they sort of allows us to take it back into the tensors. And so in our algorithm, these are sort of enacted in precisely the right places to prevent, to get rid of this short range correlations that otherwise remain and accumulate in TRG. Okay. And in particular, what you can show analytically is that if I had this CDL tensor network, this short range correlated tensor network, one iteration of TRG, I can take this to a trivial tensor network. So something with only short range correlations gets mapped into something trivial, which is what we want to happen.
In this case, is it easy to explain what the form of U is? Is it easy to say what the form of U is? Because
you can write down the form of U analytically, yeah.
Can you say it right now?
If you look, so each of these lines that pass through U is essentially a delta function. So you can in the same formalism as I used to explain CDL tensors, you can write exact form of this U, which we have in an appendix of the paper we're putting out. Yeah. So
you still preserve the scalar that you get at the end?
I mean, this is if we took away the disentanglers, then you could still choose this W and W dagger to be exactly what the previous RG scheme would give you. So anything you can do with TRG, you can at least do as accurately with this approach. So it's not clear that these W and W dagger can be chosen, like it's not clear, just immediately clear that they can be chosen such that you don't change much between here and here. But if you can do it with singular value decomposition, you can do it here also. And in practice, these disentanglers allow you to do things more accurately than just the previous scheme. Okay, so anything you do with the previous scheme, you can do more accurately here with the same bond dimension.
What is the special role of the W? Because it seems that I can put the disentanglers first and then you do the same as TRG, right? And then you get rid of the
pretty
wording.
Yeah.
Then what is the importance of putting this on it?
It's more for computational purposes, is that you have to, which is something I'm not going to talk about, is you have to choose how to put what unitaries to put there to appropriately disentangle it. And the choice of unitary is kind of, you need to know how it truncates.
You say that it's like, you want to cut the number of tensors down, but if you just did that by just grouping the lines together, everything would just blow up. So this is keeping that cost.
Yeah, but I think the question was why can't I just use singular value decomposition after I've put these unitaries here?
Okay.
In principle, you can, but you need to figure out how to do these unitaries. And in practice, it's much easier to think of these unitaries and these isometries as containing some variational parameters that need to be optimized. So it's a much easier formalism to work with to do it this way. Okay, so we have some very nice numerical methods to decide how to put U and U dagger and W and W dagger, but I'm not going to discuss these today. Okay. So now I can just give you some very brief numeric results to try and explain these main points that does TNR fix these flaws that I said were there in the previous schemes. So before we directly look at these questions, just here is some very basic numerics. So I'm looking at the classicalizing model, 2D classicalizing, on some relatively large lattice, linear dimension several thousand. Okay, and so what this plot is showing is the error in the free energy versus the temperature. And so we have for two different bond dimensions of this previous approach, TRG, versus two different bond dimensions of the new approach. And what you can see is that when you look at the error per site, this is error energy per site, TNR roughly gets a couple of orders of magnitude smaller error than the previous approach. So this is what the disentanglers are doing. They're somehow minimizing this truncation error. And here is just a plot of the spontaneous magnetization as a function of temperature, just to show, yes, we can compute local expectation values, and they're very accurate. One nice thing about this is, with our approach, even very, very close to the critical temperature, we still get an accurate value. So even at something like 0.999 TC, we can still see that we have some significant magnetization. These are not the main results. These are just to show you we have some numerical algorithm that can compute stuff, pretty much. Okay, so the more important question, as I consider it, is do we generate a proper RG flow with this approach? So this is what I've shown you several times, is what we expect for the icing model. And so what I'm plotting here is, these are just plots of the elements of these different coarse grain tensors. So I've just reshaped a four index tensor into a matrix and just plotted the elements of these matrices, where white means the largest elements. So here we started off just below the critical temperature. And so under this renormalization with TNR, we flow to some sort of very simple fixed point that only has two non-zero elements. So it's describing just this Z2 phase, where the partition function is just an equal sum of all up and all down the spins. When I start at the critical point, so my initial tensors have only changed very slightly because I've only changed the temperature slightly, but under RG, they sort of rapidly diverge. So at criticality, my A0 maps to A1, to A2, and there's essentially no difference between them. The difference between each of these is some epsilon, some numerical error, which is very small, several orders of magnitude smaller than the elements themselves. So I explicitly have this critical scale invariant fixed point. I explicitly have scale invariance when I coarse grain with TNR. And again, if I consider just above the critical temperature, things start off very similar, but you sort of rapidly diverge to a different trivial fixed point. So here I have only one element, so it's the trivial uncorrelated fixed point.
So directly we know the critical point is the unstable fixed point. So do you expect that, like, the inverts, this could also be a unstable fixed point in the future?
I think so if you, yeah, there are some numerical, this is not exactly invariant, so there are some errors that if you iterated this many times, you would eventually go to one of these two. But at least, like, for a dozen or more iterations, you seem to stay here. So it's relatively small. Okay, so we're really getting exactly what we sort of expect theoretically. And now let's look, do we get a computationally sustainable RG flow? So this is the same plot I showed you with previously when discussing TRG. And now we're looking at the spectrum of these tensors that we get with TNR is the solid lines versus TRG is the open circles. So again, if we do this comparison, what bond dimension do we need in order to have some small truncation error? This previous approach, your bond dimension scales increases very quickly. So now with TNR, you can see the spectrum is exactly the same pretty much with each step because it's scale invariant. So we can keep some small truncation error without increasing the bond dimension. And this is because we're removing the short range correlations that would otherwise accumulate. So just to give you an idea of the computational costs, so TNR scales as the bond dimension to the power of 6. You also have some sort of constant prefactor, which may be 50 or so. So when comparing the cost of doing these iterations, at first, TNR is more expensive due to this overheads. But as you iterate, TNR, the cost of doing each iteration is the same because the bond dimension is the same. So we can sort of iterate as many times as we like without losing much, whereas TRG, as we said before, it's growing exponentially. Okay, so in summary, we have this tensor network renormalization that we've introduced, whose key step is to use unitary disentanglers. So conceptually, it's very similar to what happens in the mirror, for people who know about that. And it corrects some very significant flaws in previous tensor RG schemes, in that we can have a proper RG flow, so go to the correct RG fixed points, and we can also have a sustainable RG flow at or near criticality. So this has direct applications to 2D classical and 1D quantum systems, and also to contraction of PEPs. But the main place I would like to go with this is, so all of these ideas generalize to contraction of high-dimensional tensor networks. So I would like to apply these ideas for the simulation of, say, two-dimensional quantum many-body systems. And again, this is something where this could work very nicely. It doesn't have a sign problem, where other approaches like Monte Carlo haven't been able to make progress. Okay, and just very quickly, can I take 5 minutes? People mind? Okay, so just very quickly, I'll just sketch out some ideas that I won't explain fully, just to show you some nice pictures of other things we're thinking about in relation to this. So far, we've considered RG of thinking about this as an infinite network of tensors mapping to an infinite, or periodic boundaries to periodic boundaries. What happens when we have sort of explicitly an open boundary and we do this? So we're leaving these indices untouched and we're doing some coarse graining within this. Okay, so there are a bunch of steps here that are not actually all of the steps, but this is what we get when we apply this tensor network renormalization to this open boundary case. And what we see is we have some layer of boundary tensors which connect these fine degrees of freedom to the coarser degrees of freedom in the bulk. So just to make things clear, like when we're coarse graining this tensor network, so we always have these boundary tensors appearing. It's just they don't, they always annihilate, or they usually annihilate with the ones coming from the other side. So the boundary tensors I get here would annihilate from the ones here if I put these two segments together. So if I consider, so this is considering a semi-infinite cylinder where I have the finite radius is just a periodic 1D quantum system, and this is my path integral, my Euclidean path integral for the ground state of this quantum system. When I apply TNR to this open cylinder, what I get on the boundary, so these boundary tensors accumulate that map the original degrees of freedom to the coarser degrees of freedom, and this is exactly a mirror for people who understand, who know what a mirror is. So in other words, so I'm not doing anything extra here, I'm just applying TNR to the open boundary tensor network, and it generates a mirror for the ground state directly. So this, in other words, this mirror is emergent from TNR. So I was trying to fix tensor renormalization to give me a proper RG flow, and I think we succeeded. But then when we look at it in this other context, we see it directly gives a mirror for the ground state. So this is usually, if we want to get a mirror, we do some energy minimization. The mirror is an ansatz, you propose it, you do some energy minimization. Here it just sort of emerges very naturally from this coarse graining of this bulk tensor network. Particular if we have now two open boundaries, so this is some finite open cylinder that represents e to the minus beta h for some finite beta. if we do this coarse graining, then what we get is some kind of mirror for the a thermal state of the system, where the temperature of this thermal state depends on what beta we've chosen, how thick this is. Okay, and this is very nice because previously we didn't know how to get thermal states for mirror. We had no optimization. Here it just comes out very easily. And it's one final thing. We can also mimic the effect of logarithmic transformations in conformal field theory. So if I have a 2D conformal field theory, if I want to understand the content of scaling operators, one way to do it is to change coordinates to a radial and an angular coordinate, where the radial is in logarithmic scale. So I've tried to draw it, so I map my 2D CFT to a cylinder, and transfer along this cylinder is transfer and scale for local operators. So if I diagonalize this, I can understand the scaling operators of the theory. And we can do the same thing using this TNR, where we apply the tensor network renormalization to, say, an infinite partition function that has a hole in it. And when we do that, so one iteration of that, we have our hole, and it's now connected to a bigger hole via some gates here. So if we do this several times, then we can mimic the effect of the logarithmic transformation in our partition function. So we have essentially this diagram, when viewed from inside out, is just a finite cylinder. So infinite partition function with a hole in it gets mapped to a finite cylinder. And we can diagonalize this to get out the scaling operators of this theory. So this is a very direct way of getting the conformal data of the theory, is just do the equivalent of a logarithmic transformation, then diagonalize the transfer operator of this. So it's much more direct ways of getting this information out than previous approaches using mirror. And that's a good place to stop. Thank you for your attention.
A bit late. So do you have any urgent questions? If not, we could just go for lines together. You can answer that. Any questions?
Well, at the moment, so you presented this in like with an example of the IC model, we have a square lattice, but what about if I change the form of the lattice?
You can do generalized versions of this for different lattice geometries. It should be fine. No, I want to have a picture of that.
Any other questions? All right, thank you.